Dr. Banner, now might be a really good time for you to get angry.
That's my secret, Captain. I'm always angry.
Standing alone, I saw Georgie Corn somewhere on Longacre Square. Crowds passed him by, I heard Georgie sigh. Nobody noticed him there. I asked him why he didn't smile. He said in that old Cohen style, oh, New York ain't New York anymore. How I miss those old pals of mine. The sawdust is gone from the floor, where we harmonize, sweet Adeline, on the east side, west side. Things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Yes, we hope you like us when we're angry. Hi, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And welcome back to the Angry History Show. We're laughing. We're not angry today so far. How you doing, Dean?
I'm pretty good, yeah. Good. We've had a pretty good laugh there off the air.
Probably. Technical weirdness coming in.
Yeah.
This was great. That was Russell Robinson on piano with Al Bernard singing 1925's New York Ain't New York Anymore. Of course, the sawdust is still on the floor in McSorley's, but this is a song that really fits what we'll be talking about today. An era when Times Square was still Longacre Square. And you gotta keep in mind, too, from the 20s to the 30s to the 1890s, on and on, New York ain't what it was anymore. You know, it always changes. So
yeah, there's actually a point where the author we're going to talk to today says how you can really relate to looking at some of these older pictures of New York because the layout, specifically Broadway, is so similar. And originally when I looked at this song and listened to the lyrics, I mean, I just loved it. And I thought it was about the statue of George M. Cohen that stands in Times Square. And
right.
I used to walk by that every single day. And so when he talks about it, why didn't you smile? Oh, of course, it's a statue. I thought that this was simply brilliant. You know, he stands on a pedestal next time you're in Times Square. Speaking of it not being what it was anymore, now it's a grotto. Basically, people just sit there. The Howard Johnson's is gone. So, you know, if you really need pancakes at 3 a.m., forget it now.
Right. You know what also is gone? Played there for a marvelous 8-week run in 82. Busty Dames 8. That's also gone.
And the Cape Man is also gone.
Yeah, Cape Man.
Yeah, that was a brief show on Broadway. But he stands on a pedestal, does George M. Cohen's statue, reading his most famous lyric, Give My Regards to Broadway. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised to learn, though, that the statue didn't exist till 1959. So here I'd been thinking the song was written about it, and it's still a great song. But
Right. Yes,
it was written before 110 years ago when Longacre Square changed its name in honor of the New York Times to Times Square that we know today. And I would say love, except if you ever have to cross it during tourist season,
yeah.
you don't love it so much, you try to avoid it.
It is a madhouse going through there. It's like I was never a huge Times Square guy to begin with. You know, I get it, and I appreciate all the history and all. But yeah, it's just I got a million other places I can walk, given my druthers.
Well, this song talks about it, what it was in its heyday, I guess, or its early day, or before it was Times Square. So we'll play that in its entirety at the end of the show, because we really like this song. We hope you really like it, too.
Absolutely. So now let's get to this interview from McSorley's own Lower East Side of Manhattan, not terribly far from the neighborhood I lived in for the past 20-odd years, Tribeca. And this is the museum at Eldridge Street in Chinatown, where Dean caught up with author Esther Crane. And she produces an awesome history blog called Ephemeral New York, and it's full of stories, pictures, and postcards from Gotham's past. It's a great site. I tell you, when I was first out here living in Los Angeles, and I'd get tremendously homesick, and I'd be working places, say I was working in Beverly Hills and, you know, looking out the window at the palm trees, and I would always keep Ephemeral New York and some other sites like it open on my tabs on my browser so I could just sort of dip in there and lose myself in old New York. Yeah, Esther's got a terrific, terrific site.
Yeah, it's fantastic fun for anybody who's grew up in New York or lived in New York, even if you've visited and wondered what was there.
Yeah.
I was really thrilled when I learned that Esther Crane published this new book called New York City in the Gilded Age, which is my favorite period of the City.
Yes, it is.
It features images she compiled with the New York Historical Society, and the book comes with a stereoscope, which lets you see those images of the Gilded Age city in 3D, which is something you can't do on your computer or anywhere else, really.
No, no, and it's so much fun to see this, if you can get your eyes to relax, which I actually have gotten pretty good at. The Gilded Age is roughly the period from the Civil War's end to the turn of the 20th century. It's an era of Bowery gangs and gaslights. When fair Brooklyn was still her own city, top of the food chain, as always.
Before that shotgun marriage to Manhattan.
Exactly.
Forced upon them by two parents, I guess you could say. New York State Republican boss Tom Platt, called the Easy Boss. And Tammany Hall, of course. Boss Croker would have been heading Tammany Hall at various times during that period. So they finally managed to convince Brooklyn to shed her single ways and mush into the conglomerate. But it's worth noting that the bridge still bears the Brooklyn name, because originally it didn't. It would have been called the Brooklyn
East River
York Bridge.
Right.
So.
Yep. And, and we've got some Easy Boss stories too, but not for this show today. Do we? Don't. Is that right, Dean? We'll get to him some other day.
Yeah, we'll get to him. And it's funny, when I said that this is my favorite era of the city, Owen and I were meeting one day on the streets, and we realized when we were trying to give each other landmarks that when you have a guy, remember that?
Yeah,
it's so funny.
That was hilarious.
Like when you have a guy with a map of 1901 of Manhattan in his head, and a guy that has a map of 1941 about in his head, and they're trying to meet and say 2009, 2008.
Right. Exactly.
It's hard to find your way. Yeah.
Man. So, Dean, from my perspective, the building I want you to meet me at was destroyed 40 years ago. From your perspective, it's going to be 30 years until it's built. I'll see you there. So.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah. But first up, we have Esther Crane doing a reading from her book. And this is the story of crusading journalist Elizabeth Jane Cochran. Anyone want to take a gander what her nom de guerre is?
Wait, don't tell me. Nellie
Bly. She wasn't the first to write about the deplorable condition suffered by poor and mentally ill New Yorkers, but she was the first to write about it so well that she moved people to act, which is sort of the benchmark. Here we go. Here is Esther.
This is the story of Nellie Bly, who was a pioneering journalist in the 1880s. And the amazing thing about Nellie Bly is that she was only 23 years old and female in an industry at the time that was almost entirely male. Is titled Horror in a City Lunatic Hospital. Who is this insane girl? Asked a New York Sun article on September 25, 1887. The story told of a modest, comely, well-dressed girl of 19 who gave her name as Nellie Brown, who was committed by Justice Duffy of Essex Market yesterday for examination of her sanity. The unknown girl was then taken to Bellevue, and though doctors were sure she was insane, they were puzzled as to who she was and where she was from. 10 days later, they and the rest of the city would find out. The insane girl was Nellie Bly, the pen name of Elizabeth Jane Cochran, a 23-year-old investigative reporter sent by Joseph Pulitzer's sensational New York World to get herself committed to the Women's Lunatic Asylum on Blackwell's Island and write a story about the conditions she encountered there. Various city newspapers had covered the disturbing criminal conditions at the asylum over the years since it opened in 1839. But it was Bly's experience that prompted an outraged city to demand change. Her series of articles chronicled 10 days in the rat-infested building, eating rotting food, showering with buckets of cold water, and enduring forced isolation. What, accepting torture, would produce insanity quicker than this treatment, she wrote. Take a perfectly sane and healthy woman, shut her up and make her sit from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on straight back benches. Do not allow her to talk or move during these hours. Give her no reading and let her know nothing of the world or its doings. Give her bad food and harsh treatment, and see how long it will take to make her insane. 2 months would make her a mental and physical wreck. Responding to criticism triggered by Bly's searing articles, the city drastically increased funding to the Commission of Public Charities and Corrections so that upgrades would be made at the asylum. Bly herself was invited to tour the facilities a month later, and she reported that many of the worst offenses had been corrected. The lunatic asylum closed for good in 1894, its patients transferred to a facility for the insane on Ward's Island.
Cochran took that alias from the 1850 pop song, as much as they had pop songs in the 1850s, and yes, they did have popular songs. The song was called Nellie Bly, and you heard it playing there under Esther Crane's reed. Her tale of that asylum reminds me of 1948's The Snake Pit. Have you seen that, Owen?
I never saw that. Nope.
Yeah, it stars Olivia de Havilland as a woman with real mental breakdown happening. And the past medical thinking, as we say, you don't want to condescend to people. I'm sure we're wrong about many, many things we think we know now, but it often seems very childlike. And I was saying this to her, we were discussing her book. I said, you know, they would literally drop you into a snake pit if you were mentally ill. And the thinking, again, childlike, the only way I could describe it, child logic, was something that would drive a sane person insane would drive an insane person back into sanity.
Yes, and that works great. And that goes right up there with, you know, leechings and, you know, exorcisms. It's great sound medical science right there.
Well, you could see, like, the things that they did, like leeching. Okay, you know, they still
actually, leeching works.
Today. Yeah, they use them today if you have a severed limb. So I step back into the medical field. But, right. You know, if you have a severed finger, you want to pull the blood out there maybe, so they'll put a leech on it and try to draw it into the limb that they've reattached.
Right.
But there could never have been anybody who came out of the snake pit and said, oh, man, I feel so much better. Thank you.
Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes?
Yes, this is really wonderful. Thanks for all you've done for me. Now I feel totally unhinged and filled with rage, but thanks a lot. Oh, boy. So listen, now that we've had a taste of the book, let's take a trip back to the days of ragtime music with Esther Crane, author of New York City in the Gilded Age, as interviewed by Dean on the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
I'm here with Esther Crane, author of the new book and the fantastic box set with stereoscopic pictures, New York City in the Gilded Age. Ms. Crane is a native New Yorker, editor, and writer. She also runs the website Ephemeral New York under the tagline, Chronicling an Ever-Changing City Through Faded and Forgotten Artifacts. Thank you so much for talking with Angry History today.
Thank you guys for coming down.
Now, you've been kind enough to spare some time with us today right before your official book launch. We're in the basement of the Museum at Eldridge Street on New York's Lower East Side, which is inside a 126-year-old synagogue built in 1887. And you can learn more about this place, by the way, at eldridgestreet.org. How did you choose this spot for your party?
Well, as a New Yorker, I've always loved coming down here. The Eldridge Street Synagogue is a real treasure, a little New York gem. It's a beautiful, restored synagogue building. And just being here, you feel the ghosts of old New York. And I happened to get a message from someone from the museum who told me that she really enjoyed the website, Ephemeral New York, that I produce. So the next time I came down here, I sought her out and we talked for a long time. And the idea to hold the book launch was born. We both thought it was just a really appropriate, inspiring venue.
There was a story last week, actually, about the museum at Eldridge Street. And the New York Times had a funny line that I wrote down. Quote, when visitors ask why a great synagogue was built in the middle of Manhattan's Chinatown, it is clearly time for a history lesson. Tell us what it was like back in the Gilded Age to be in this neighborhood. It's quite different, right?
Very different. I mean, you can see by the tenements surrounding the synagogue that this was one crowded neighborhood. And you just imagine that each one of those tenements, each apartment, say, you know, the couple of apartments at least per floor, had huge families of immigrants. And you can imagine how many people were hanging out the windows and in the streets. And the synagogue was probably actually a nice little break from tenement life. It's very spacious, and it's a very inspiring place to be.
And this was also just recently redone and kind of in the spirit of the tenement museum that's not far away. And you were talking about some of the tenement reform acts, because originally the tenement was built as kind of the ideal modern urban living. And then when you look at some of the pictures here that you compiled with the New York Historical Society for New York City in the Gilded Age, you kind of get an idea that it was a rough time to live.
Oh, yeah. And people don't realize that the landlords charged a lot of money to live here. I mean, they knew that there were immigrants pouring in that needed places to live, and they took advantage of that. It wasn't cheap to live in a tenement, but what you got for your money was pretty bad. They were grimy, they were dark, they were damp, they were dirty. Life was not easy in a tenement apartment. If you had an outside-facing window, you were lucky. If you had your own water closet in the actual tenement and not an outhouse out back, that would be a plus, too. It wasn't until the New Law Tenement Act was passed in 1901 that reforms came in. Things like all apartments had to have an outside-facing window and get fresh air and light, and every apartment had to have its own bathroom.
Now, you said that the book, New York City in the Gilded Age, was inspired by ephemeral New York. I signed up for those emails probably as soon as you launched it in 2008, and we tweet out every one of your stories at Angry History. It's that good. You just got on Twitter, I think, fairly recently, at Ephemeral NY.
Yeah.
And your website is ephemeralnewyork.wordpress.com. Again, we'll link to all that at angryhistory.com. But it's that good that you, if you're a history person, you want to tweet out everything.
Oh, it's really born out of my love and fascination with New York City. Technology now, you can, you know, you don't rely on a publisher to kind of get your thoughts and your emotions, you know, out there to find an audience. You can set up a website yourself, and that's really what I did. Without any kind of plan or any aim for it, just as a way to sort of share my love of the city and the little corners and pockets of mystery and beauty that we find every day when you look around.
And the book, Owen and I pre-ordered ours, sitting here on the table. It comes in a Victorian-style box labeled New York City in 3D in the Gilded Age, and it's really unlike any box set I've seen. It's kind of a time machine with the stereoscope inside. Describe what people get when they pick up the book.
Well, you get a real book. So there's an actual book just about the Gilded Age with wonderful pictures, very rarely seen images from the fantastic archives at the New York Historical Society. You also get 50 stereoscopes, very rare images, also from the New York Historical Society library, and a stereoscope to view them through. These are stereographs, and if you have an interest in photography, you've probably seen them. They're late 19th century sort of hardback cardboard photos, and it looks like there's two images side by side on the piece of cardboard. When you look through the stereoscopic viewer, it actually comes to life as a 3D image. And this was pretty neat for 19th century people in the 19th century. It was a new way to see the city and the world. It was a very popular pastime to collect and view them.
When Owen and I, anyway, were growing up in the 70s and probably in the 60s, they had the ViewMaster, which was kind of similar to the stereoscope. I was wondering, I know the book is brand new, but have you had any reaction from young people who today, and in kind of an era of iPhones in modern time, have ever looked at one?
The reaction is, wow, cool, which is pretty neat because they are cool. They are a little bit like the ViewMasters. I had many of those growing up too. But when I look through it and I look at the images, I like to imagine myself, you know, as somebody from the Gilded Age looking at these for the first time, and things really come to life. And this is the first time that people were able to look at a 3D image. And this is before movies, before TV and everything. And this was kind of like the first quasi-motion picture entertainment. Is very popular.
So you heard it here first. New York City in the Gilded Age. Ideal for children.
Kids seem to really like it, actually. You know, kids love those gadgety things.
Yeah.
And this is a new one. Not too many kids have stereoscopes, you know.
I think when you get to be a certain age, anything that's retro, it always has some kind of appeal. And I think if that's how you turn kids on to the past, obviously it's a big mission of ours, and you with Ephemeral New York at the website. If this is how you turn them onto it, I could see if I was a kid staring at that for a long time, because I've spent a lot of time digging for pictures of this era, and a lot of these really are new. They're not ones you're just going to find tossed around on various websites when people want to get things wrong about the Gilded Age.
Yeah, we were pretty careful to make sure that we selected images for the book and also for the stereoscopes that had not been out there and were rarely seen, if ever seen. So there's some pretty good stuff.
Seems like it's a good introduction for those poor souls, as TR might have called them, who have never visited this vibrant period of Tenderloin bars and Tammany Hall. So who did you have in mind for picking it up? What kind of people are you getting a reaction from now that it's out?
Well, definitely from New Yorkers, whether they're native New Yorkers or they just moved here 2 years ago or they're relatively new. They seem to love it. I mean, it really gives this sense of the city. At the time, the city really coalesced into the modern city that we know it today. Not just the geography of the city, but kind of the idea of being a New Yorker really came about in the Gilded Age. And then anybody who just loves history and, you know, can't pass up a black and white photo without looking at it and wondering, you know, who are these people? What was this building? Who lived here? What was life like? I really tried to not just present kind of a linear history, but to really give a feel for how people in the Gilded Age lived of all classes, what they did work-wise, what they did for pleasure and leisure. And I hope that readers get a sense of just day-to-day life. What were the comforts in your home, if you were lucky enough to have them? Where did you shop? What did you eat? What was in the newspaper at the time? That kind of day-to-day living is what I'm interested in as a person who loves history, rather than kind of the linear, you know, this was invented then, and then this was invented then, which is kind of how history is presented in school when you're a kid, which is why I think a lot of kids don't like history.
Yeah, it just becomes memorizing yet another thing. And for us, we've said many times when we started wanting to do this history show, you want to take dusty pictures from history and say these people weren't just, you know, that 2 seconds that somebody sits there in a chair in Matthew Brady's studio. They had happiness and sadness and joy, and their stomachs hurt when they ate too much or when they drank too much, in Grover Cleveland's case, maybe, or, you know, any of these people. Like, they had real lives. And you look at some of these pictures in your book, especially now with the stereoscope, ways you can't look at it at home, and it really brings that home. They can almost step out of the picture and tell you a story, even though it might be the only time in their life they ever had their picture taken. Especially the kids, they mug for the camera immediately in a way that the adults were still kind of Victorian, some of, most of them, I guess. You know, but the kids are still very vibrant paper boys and such.
Oh, yeah, it's great. And what's really, what makes it really easy to relate to is the fact that the geography of the city that we know today with Broadway and the avenues and then the street grid was really all in place. So it's very easy. You know, you're not just looking at a street that doesn't look familiar. You can easily say, well, that's Broadway. These people are shopping on Broadway, or they're going to the theater. They're getting a cab. It's a horse-drawn cab, but it's still a cab. And that's how we live in New York today. It's very easy to relate to, and it's fascinating how things have changed, but the life in the city has not changed that much. Sort of the day-to-day routines that people had, they were all established by the Gilded Age.
And consolidation was only at 1900, so it's really the dawn of Greater New York. They don't say Greater New York so much anymore, but at least when I was a kid, they still said it some.
Yeah, it's great too. The story of consolidation I find fascinating because they first introduced the idea in the 1860s, and then in the 1880s it really started to gather steam, mostly because the Brooklyn Bridge really linked the cities of Brooklyn and Manhattan together. But Brooklyn held out. They held out for a long time until finally in the 1890s, you know, they accepted. And then the night before consolidation was to take effect, which I believe was January 1st, 1898, the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, the daily paper of the city of Brooklyn, wrote something about this is Brooklyn's funeral. But in its place of the city of Brooklyn, we have the borough of Brooklyn and the city of Greater New York. You know, it was all born in the Gilded Age.
We kind of put quotation marks around angry in the idea of Angry History Show. And it's sort of those historical facts you get passionate about. And so I wanted to ask you if you have one of those misconceptions that comes up a lot about the Gilded Age, or just a general history thing when you tell people you do Ephemeral New York, that kind of gets you going in a 5-minute speech. I know, for instance, people that confuse the Roosevelts. I was at Sagamore Hill one day and I heard a woman asking her husband if he was the one in the wheelchair. And
how can you confuse the Roosevelts? That's crazy. But I think that people think Gilded Age means that everybody was having a great time. It was just a grand old party. Money's coming in. The city is booming. Becomes, you know, essentially the financial capital of the nation and one of the financial capitals of the world. There's balls, there's high society. And I think when people think Gilded Age, they think of that. And that's all true. But you also had two very, very deep recessions, panics they called them at the time. And you had so many immigrants coming in with nothing. And the poverty was tremendous. And there was no safety net as we know it today. There was no, I guess, what we would call welfare. There was no food stamps. You weren't totally on your own. You had benevolent societies and you had religious groups and ethnic groups. And you also had, you know, corrupt Tammany Hall politicians ready to, you know, give people a little money to buy their vote. The flip side of the Gilded Age was, you know, it was pretty bad. There was some pretty deep poverty and a lot of suffering.
In fact, the term Gilded Age wasn't that Mark Twain, and it was sort of with some sarcasm to
it. Right, exactly. Gilded meaning gilded on the surface and, you know, rotten at the core. But we kind of sometimes forget that.
Well, with the pictures in the book, you get a pretty broad cross-section. It's easy to overlook it because, for instance, you don't really see pictures of those horrible outhouses that would serve an entire block. But you can find them if you choose to look. You spared us that in New York City in the Gilded Age. One book that people are probably familiar with, at least the title, is How the Other Half Lives by T.R.'s friend Jacob Riis. In fact, when Theodore Roosevelt read that book, he sent Jacob Riis a card over at the New York Sun and said simply, "I'm here to help." And so that's how they got to be friends. But he was a groundbreaking photojournalist who came with nothing, literally, tried to stay in one of these houses and saw the misery of it and really tried to change it.
Yeah, and I think that people today generally acknowledge that a lot of those photos were a bit posed, perhaps. At the same time, so what? It still tells us how deep the poverty was and that, how many, what they called at the time, street Arabs, meaning homeless kids, there were out there, and how bad things were for a lot of the people in the Gilded Age.
And in fairness to Riis, first of all, the technology had to pose some of them, but also if he seemed to overstate any of that, he actually understated it in his headline, because it probably would have been more like the two-thirds that were living in the tenement, and maybe a third that had servants and whatnot. So he probably a little bit understated it there. But it gave rise to a lot of things like parks. I was going to mention that Sarah Delano Park's not far from here. That would have been all tenements, and it sort of created this movement to make urban space more livable.
In fact, when they opened Seward Park, which was not the first playground, but one of the first playgrounds, Jacob Riis was there, and he spoke. There were thousands of kids like waiting for him to stop speaking so they could just get in the playground. But he was such a big reform movement leader at the time that he came to actually witness the birth of the playgrounds and the parks and other progressive reforms of the era.
And I think I might have stepped on your answer when I asked you about, does anything get you worked up when people ask you, is there a common misconception that somebody tells you, or even just a thing you're really passionate about that you love to talk people about? Like Sarah Vowell says, when she goes to weddings, she'd find herself saying, "Don't bring up McKinley, don't bring up McKinley." So do you have any things like that?
I'm always surprised to hear about the incredible benevolence on the part of many of the richest New Yorkers. I'm not saying that they are saints or anything like that, but you have someone like Louis Fleischman, who was a very rich bakery owner. His family actually ended up developing Fleischman's yeast, which is in the supermarkets today. He had a fancy Viennese bakery on 10th Street and Broadway. And he was the first person who started a bread line in which he ran for 40 years and for many of those years personally supervised giving away the bread that hadn't sold for the day to any hungry man who was willing to queue up online and wait for it. And that's how we got the term bread line. And he took a lot of heat for that because the prevailing idea at the time among a lot of people in New York was that you don't give out charity. It's okay to help people, but you have to ask for something in return, either work or you might charge a few cents. And his answer to that was, "These men are hungry and that's enough for me."
Do you have a favorite picture in your book?
There are so many photos and images in this book that I love. I'm so happy that they made it in the book and we didn't have to cut any. But I would say that my favorite is we have this wonderful photo of the very rich wife of one of the Vanderbilt sons. Her name is Alice Vanderbilt, and she was attending a ball and wore an electric dress. And the electric dress is so wild. At the time, it was a wild thing. I mean, she had a battery pack and it lit up. And it was really to celebrate the idea that we had this thing called electricity. We had light. We weren't relying on dirty, stinky gas lamps anymore. And I love it because it's so ostentatious and so out there, but it just symbolizes this is the Gilded Age, kind of brought the light to New York City.
That is great. Again, the book is New York City in the Gilded Age. You can get it in the box set, complete with a stereoscope, which many of you, I'm willing to bet, have never seen or tried to use.
It's cool. You gotta check it out. It's pretty cool.
It really is. It's fantastic. And I'm gonna ask you to sign my book, so that'll be great. I appreciate you doing that. I appreciate you so much making the time right before your book launch at the museum at Elder Street. Good luck in your launch party and with the book.
Thank you so much. And thank you again for coming out. It's been great talking to you, fellow Gilded Age lover.
I really want to thank Esther Crane for sitting down with me, as well as the ladies who manage the museum at Eldridge Street. You could do far worse and not too much better, I think, for a place that you want to go that's off the beaten path. You know, there's a lot of places that are the main flashy things, but this, if you love just looking at old tile work and, you know, old electrical and gas lamps that have been converted to electricity, this is just a place you can stare, and they have great stories of how, you know, within our living memory, this place was a wreck. 15 years ago, before they did this big renovation, there were pigeons living in there, and it was just a mess. And it's nice to see people come together again, although some of them, it was hard to get them to come back. They said, you know, I spent my whole life trying to get off the Lower East Side. You want me to come back?
Right.
Yeah, and that New York Times story that we'll link to. Yep. But if you're in Chinatown, check it out. You can go to eldridgestreet.org and see about visiting. It really represents the melting pot of New York City that we love, that you see so much in those pictures of the Gilded Age. And that part of New York is still New York, despite the song. They had, the weekend before we did this interview, their annual Egg Rolls and Egg Creams Festival, which brings together the neighborhood's past and present immigrants.
Yeah, I love that. I was actually down there, and I got there just too late to go to the festival, but the poster for it, Egg Rolls and Egg Creams, cracked me up. It says pretty much all you need to know about the immigrant legacy in the neighborhood. And it was interesting down there, too. I was walking with my buddy Yuki. A buddy of his opened up this coffee shop on East Broadway, which is just right around there. And I first started hanging out in that neighborhood back in, I guess, 85 or so. I was 15. I was over at Xavier on 16th Street. And one of my favorite dim sum restaurants in the world is, you know, three or so blocks from the museum. It was Wing Shing on Rutgers and East Broadway. Now it's Wing Shun, but the taro root cookies cannot be beat. But that place is so interesting. It's gentrifying hard now, too. If you walk down, it's one of the adjoining blocks where the museum is. It's like got their little tiny coffee shops now. It's got these sort of very trendy little boutiques that are coming up, and that's, you know, I mean, that's just the way it is, you know, and it's going to happen to the Lower East Side too. You know, it was really funny. It was I got my copy of the book a couple of days ago, and it was awesome and just so much fun to look through stereoscopes. It's a gadget. It's a contraption, and it's so cool the way it pulls back, and you slide the stereographic image in there and put it up to your eyes. And if you just, like I said before, if you can let your eyes relax a little bit, you're treated to this wonderful image. Try to do it with the light behind you as best you can. But I was showing it to my boy, my 3-year-old, and of course he was totally digging it and like the whole science of it. The first thing he said was, "These are Darth Vader eyes." And I was like, "No, they're not Darth Vader eyes. This is from the 1800s. But then I got, you know, I figured having a debate with him over that wasn't the wisest thing in the world. but he loved it, putting it on. He's like, "Oh, look at the castles. Look at the Brooklyn Bridge." And then he said, "Look, the air train." I'm like, "All right, what is he looking at?" So he was embellishing. But it is such a great, great thing to sit. And I just have it out now. I have it out on the coffee table to sort of, you know, hopefully he'll always pick it up or guests will come. And it's a perfect thing to have out, you know, not just a conversation starter because of the fun toy aspect of it, but it's, you know, you really do get a wonderful glimpse of our town.
Yeah, there is the elevated train that's right by there. Mm-hmm. And that's something, it's nice. It's one of those things where if you live there, maybe it's, you hear it, you just get used to it or it bothers you. But when you visit these places and you're not used to it, it's so great to hear she's speaking there, doing a reading from a book, and the L train goes by.
That's
and
great.
Though that's a real sound of old New York, and you can pick that up there where we don't hear the L's anymore running up 6th Avenue or 3rd Avenue past McSorley's. So you can really see it, and I'm so glad that you enjoyed the book and you were able to give it to your son and he picked up on it, because I just found that fascinating through a child's eyes to look into that and see these 3D pictures for the first time.
Well, that's it. You know, I forced him to look at all the Matthew Brady ones that they did from the war, but for some reason that didn't work out too well either. I got yelled at by my
Might be a little too young for Gettysburg.
Yeah, it's true. But you know what? It's funny. I do actually have that, the stereoscopic book of that, which, again, goes into the let's wait and look at this one later, son, pile.
Yeah, you know. Piles of limbs, usually five, six, I think.
That was in my house, that's what it was. Yeah, they wouldn't let me go see Jaws at 5, but Texas Chainsaw Massacre at 6 I was allowed to do. What a difference a year makes. That's wrong. Everyone knows Chainsaw came out in 74. Sorry, he caught me lying. Damn you, history! No! I just wanted to say, too, listening to this interview of you guys, you both were, it's so nice when you hear people passionate about their subjects, and you guys had a really nice back and forth going, and she really is dynamite. She loves her city so much. It was a real treat to just sit and listen to it. I wish I was there for it, but I'm glad you guys made it happen. So cool.
Well, I wanted to bring it to everybody. As I said, this is a period that I love, a website that I love. So I said it's going to be a book that I love. So why not make the effort, try to get down there, and hopefully people will like it as much as we do and be able to visit the period a little bit and find so many things that are really are echoes of today, as she was saying. You know, the layout of the city is the same. unlike a lot of cities, there are still places like this you can find.
Yep.
Since the demolition of Penn Station, tragically, New York has really focused a lot on protecting things in history.
Oh, yeah.
So, well, at least we can try to find some of those little pieces left. And every person that goes and visits one, you save a little bit of it by doing that, by sharing it.
Absolutely. It's funny. You talk about these things and then landmark preservation. The house in which I grew up in Fort Greene in downtown Brooklyn was built in 1862. So, you know, cast your mind back. That is an old, nice old house. But there were so many artifacts within the house itself. I mean, the house itself was a piece of history. You know, you would walk in, you'd go up the staircase, and there would be this sort of curved little hutch. And it was the coffin nook, the coffin niche. You know, it's like when they would have funerals in the house, they would bring the coffin up to the top of the stairs and use that little hutch as your angle to get it over the railing and then into the bedroom or whatever, wherever it was the wake was going to be held. And it's just, you know, we had those in my house. You know, we had plugged up gas lamps in my house. Probably a lot of asbestos. I'll let you know how that turns out in a couple of years. But yeah, it was just an amazing house to grow up in, knowing what was going on in the city at the time, and you know, knowing that that house stood through the Gilded Age, through everything up until this very day. It's kind of great growing up in a museum, except for all the layers of linoleum and all the child labor laws my parents had to break. Speaking of Jacob Riis.
We also mentioned the Orchard Street, which is not far away. That's where the Truman Museum is. And speaking of a building that's preserved from the way it was back then, you can go through there and see a bunch of the different ways people lived in apartments back then in the Gilded Age and then in before World War II. You know, big picture of FDR on the walls everyone had. And that's a good museum to go to if you really want to take a walk back, feel jute wallpaper, you know, see that tile work we were talking about, see the wood. She talked about having a water closet in your apartment being a big amenity. See what it really looked like, you know.
Right.
There's no Glade plug-in, there's no fan.
No.
But you were still glad to have it. It just makes you so appreciative
of
what we have now that we, you know, we complain if there's no toilet paper. Talk about no toilet paper. I mean, what if there was never any toilet paper?
Right. Exactly. And it wasn't a New York Post to clean yourself with. But it's funny. If you do want to go to that museum, which is wonderful, I recommend it. Not only can you go to Katz's Deli, which is pretty close by after, you absolutely should. But if you're in the city around Halloween, and I hope they still do it, and we can check and we'll put it up on the site, but they always do a great tenement haunted house walkthrough, which is it's so unpleasant and pleasant at the same time. But it's like all of the most horrifying aspects of how the other half lives in those photographs, they bring to life in this tenement. It's really great stuff, extremely creepy. So give it a shot.
I like how you say, oh, Katz's Deli is great, people should go there. Ladies and gentlemen, do you know how many times this gentleman and I have left the Russian Turkish baths on 10th Street? When was that built, Owen? 1880s,
1892.
Right? 1892. We've left there with the plan of going to Katz's Deli, and then we get about to 7th Street.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
Somebody who will not be named, but his name begins with a vowel, says, well, you know, we could go to McSorley's instead.
Oh, yeah, it's me. It's always me. Me. I know. Dean's like, no, I'd much rather go somewhere else. And it's me who always drags us to McSorley's.
Oh, Katz's Deli. Yeah, you people have definitely got to go, except, you know, that McSorley's is there.
Listen, if
they... Littlehorse sandwich.
Right, exactly. If they'd put the Russian baths on, you know, 4th Street instead of 10th Street, we'd be in Katz's all the time because we'd be heading south. Next time I'll be back, you know what, I'll be back in about a week. We have to make sure we do it, so.
All right, I'll be there.
Because let's just put it this way. If it's not the black cherry soda, it's the root beer. And if it's not the root beer, it's the birch beer. So we've got a lot of good reasons to go down there. And I'm good for at least, you know, 3 hot dogs.
Yeah.
Gosh, I love that place. We were talking. I can't help it. And you know what? It's like, send a song to your boy in the army for years and years and years. That was such a almost charming throwback to our times of war. Now, of course, we've been at war longer than any other point in our history. They still do it. You know, if you have someone who you love who's stationed elsewhere, you can send them a salami, which is fantastic, from our good friends at Katz's.
Speaking of war, it's worth noting that we're recording this on June 28th, 2014, and that's 100 years to the day that Gavrilo Princip shot Archduke Ferdinand and his wife, setting off the First World War. So this is a real historic day, and it's one of those days everything changed. It's one of those days.
Oh my gosh.
You look back and you say, what if, what if, what if? Hero or villain? They say Sarajevo's about split on the question, which is... tells you a little bit about history and about the victors writing it and how people feel about somebody. But his action did set it off. Everybody started ramping up, eventually dragged in the United States and laid the groundwork for, of course, the Second World War.
I wonder about that with him. I mean, Princip, when he was 19, he was a student, and he had like a half dozen co-conspirators with him that day. And I know that like one of the guys chucked a grenade and it blew up under the car behind it. And somehow the crowd was so sort of loud that no one really noticed that a grenade went off. And everyone started to go and do their thing. But Princep was like, wait a second, I'm kind of standing here. I'm 5 paces away from this guy right now. And he took his shot, literally. And man, oh man, did this guy change the world. I would like to, I know he survived it and I know he testified. I'd be interested to know what his thoughts were about the trigger that he pulled and the cataclysm he set off. I can't imagine he ever thought it would be that big.
Yeah, well, there had been so many. Through the Gilded Age, there were many anarchist assassinations. Of course, William McKinley, one of them.
Yep.
There are a lot of people shooting for various reasons as sort of this birth pains of a new world that came out of these old dying empires, specifically the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So, you know, there was a lot of those, and none of those had the impact this did. And I think something would have been the spark. It just happened to be him.
Yeah, it's crazy. This is a centennial year of the Great War, the war that changed everything. And we're certainly going to do a full episode on that and try to offer some context and our perspective. But in the meantime, we're going to leave you with 1925's New York Ain't New York Anymore. Once again, Dean.
And this is the song expressing to everyone how that Great War really put the nail in the coffin of Cohen's old New York, the New York of the Gilded Age. Now, if you want to find it, you do have to get a book and a stereoscope, and we just recommended you a very good one.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us this week, folks. And again, you can follow Ephemeral New York online, on Facebook, Twitter at Ephemeral NY, or by signing up for their emails, and then you don't have to do anything but check your inbox.
That's right. And I want to thank Esther again. It was really great for her to come on, especially right as she was about to do her own launch. And you know what I'm going to do today? I am in Southern California, but I'm going to do my best to find both an egg roll and an egg cream.
Hey, good.
Yep. Gotta be done. Hey, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And thanks again for joining us on the Angry History Show. We'll see you guys next time.
Standing alone, I saw Georgie Corn somewhere on Long Acre Square. Crowds passed him by, I heard Georgie sigh. Nobody noticed him there. I asked him why he didn't smile. In that old Cohen style. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore. How I miss those old pals of mine. The sawdust is gone from the floor where we harmonize sweet Adeline. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. Tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore. I remember, he said, when I first hit Broadway, New York was New York and the white way was gay. There were Sherry's and Murray's and Rector's, you know, the Claridge and Churchill's and Delmonico. Music and laughter and the prices were right. A $10 bill meant a wonderful night.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or stream it through one of iHeartRadio's many mobile platforms, including their smartphone apps, Roku, or car stereo station. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send an email to angry@angryhistory.com. We'd love to hear your feedback.
And then came the day Broadway wasn't prepared, when the newsboys yelled extra, war is declared. But the hand that held glasses of wine in the air were the first to hold guns when I rode over there. The boys won the war and came home from the fight. The last night on Broadway was Armistice night. But ever since then, it's a different street. Gone are the places where the gang used to meet. We still call it Broadway, but what's in a name? Take it from Georgie, it isn't the same. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore.